History 101, Lecture 21, The Rise of Ideologies. Nationalism was in many ways the most effective, the most widespread, and as it were, the most fit for export ideology of the 19th century. Those comprehensive interpretations of society that called upon every common person to most fully realize his human potential and thus approximate God, as political philosopher Roberto Mangabeira Unger puts it. As they are focused upon realizing the human potential and the salvation within the existing society, in the here and now, rather than calling upon humans to withdraw from it, they are linked to the Semitic salvation religions. Whereas even the better world they promise is located at some exact point in time, the coming of the Mahdi or of the Messiah, rather than having to be achieved by each believer individually retreating from the circle of rebirth, as Hinduism or Buddhism argue. Now, in a still largely completely Christian, or for that matter, Islamic universe, revolutionary movements that criticized the existing order and might call for the overthrow of it tended to take the shape of chiliastic or millenarian movements. That is, that once the demands of the movement are realized, so to say, the ground has been prepared for the coming of the Messiah or Christ or the Mahdi. Such was the case with radical Anabaptism in Western Europe in the 16th century, or radical Twelver Shiism in Iran in the same period. But in the more secularized environment of the 19th and 20th century, movements calling for an overthrow of the existing order tend to be clothed as secular ideologies rather than in millenarian terms. Now, ideologies can be understood, to follow Karl Mannheim, as cognitive maps to the everyday world, collective experiments in making sense of and giving expression to our everyday world experience. To follow Mannheim still further, the dominant group, whether that be the dominant class or men against women, tends to argue that change undermining the existing social order or the hierarchy of the sexes is either impossible or undesirable, generally both. They are conservatives. The mode of thinking of the subaltern group is commonly expressed in utopian thinking, the longing for a better future. Be that in the rather trivial form of the average novel for ladies, or be it expressed in various designs for an ideal society, whether that be one with equality between the classes or equality between men and women. Yet such ideological roadmaps to everyday existence were from the 18th century onward increasingly filled in secular rather than in religious terms. Or, to state it more broadly, they were no longer justified by appealing to some transcendental authority, like God in the Christian and Islamic tradition, or Dharma in the Hindu or Buddhist tradition. Thus, the rise of secular ideologies was not only linked to the Enlightenment, with its call to independently examine any judgment, which is more or less a truism, but was linked to the increasing penetration of science into everyday life in the 19th century as well, and to the simultaneous expansion of the scientific method to cover increasingly more spheres of knowledge and of life. Modern science basically started with mathematics with the ancient Greeks. It encompassed the universe in the 17th century. It covered all of physical nature with geology, biology, or geography in the 18th century, and then expanded still further to encompass human society with economics and the new science of sociology that arose in the 1820s. Until, finally, science covered human reasoning as well with the new science of psychology. By the late 19th century, science had become a comprehensive, all-encompassing edifice that covered every aspect of human society as much as nature. Science, however, did not offer comprehensive guidelines on how to lead one's life, or what better society one was to aim for. 4. In the so-called historic school of law, the so-called scientific study of history, or the Bible critical school of theology, the dominant way of looking at society was historicism. Historicism was not, as it is often supposed to be in the Anglo-Saxon countries nowadays, due to a very misleading work of philosopher Karl Popper, The Poverty of Historicism, that dates from the 1950s, the idea that history is guided by iron laws, as rather the precise opposite. In historicism, everything, human culture, institutions, practices, or rationality, was made by history, so that nothing had an eternal form, an eternal essence, or an identity that transcended change. And as everything in human history was made by history, everything was the product of the historic processes that brought it into being as well. As that was so, there was, in historicism, no such thing as lessons from history. Since history never repeats itself, neither can it offer us any guidelines to the future, nor can the present or future allow us an insight into the past, as our interpretation of the past changes together with history itself. Furthermore, historicism insisted on holism, that is, that there is no eternal essence of the human being, but that the human being itself is embedded within historic processes. As the social sciences could therefore offer no definitive roadmaps to the future or guidelines on what policy to follow, it was up to the ideologies to draw political guidelines from the supposed objective facts presented by history or social sciences. Thus, both dominant ideologies, as they emerged in the 19th century, classic liberalism and social democracy claim to be positivist and scientific, or at least they claim to be guided by science. Indeed, several prominent revolutionaries of the 19th century, such as Mikhail Bakunin or Pyotr Kropotkin, had a scientific background. So too, in a way, did the two forms of reactions thereto, though the former in partly denying those claims, and the last one in completely denying those claims, conservatism and fundamentalism. Fundamentalism basically argues that modern society, in denying fundamental truths of the faith, has brought about a disintegration of society, expressed in such things as lewd behavior, prostitution, drinking, and so on, and that the only way of curing those evils is a return to the Holy Scriptures. Now, it is probably true that in response to what it perceives as an ever-increasing attack of both science and modern consumerism on vested religion, fundamentalism has increased strongly in the last half of the 20th century. However, fundamentalism is by itself not new, and arose in Islam with the prophetic Wahhabit movements of the 18th century and the Mahdist one of the 19th century. And in Europe, it arose very much as a criticism of the French Revolution. For instance, the founder of the first Dutch political party, the Anti-Revolutionary Party, Groen van Prinsterer, wrote in 1847 that the only way to stem what he termed the crisis of the modern age, which he equaled with reckless exploitation of the working man by the capitalist, and the aimless drifting of one system of government to another, was caused by the Christians recklessly forsaking or doubting the truth, the only truth that was given in the Bible, and that therefore Christians should not remain alien to the fields of politics, in his terms, as that was the only way of curing all those ills of modern society, ills that were caused by doubt in the authority of the Scriptures. Like fundamentalism, conservatism was a critique of the Enlightenment in general, and of the French Revolution in particular. Yet though it often perceives religion as a useful, even a vital element, to keep societies together, it did not proceed from religion. Conservatism argued societies were organic wholes that had arisen over centuries and that were so complicated that no single person or an institution could claim to possess the key to understand exactly how they worked. Therefore, the conservatives claimed, total and cohesive view on how humans in society functioned was not only impossible, but such abstract schemes had to be rejected. And as society was a result of a slow, organic growth, any attempt to intervene in its developments had to be rejected too. For all such attempts resulted merely in the curtailment of individual liberty for the supposed greater good of mankind, or sacrificing present happiness to the greater good in the future. Furthermore, hierarchy and leadership were a natural characteristic of any civil society. Without it, societies would disintegrate, and inequality was thus not merely unavoidable, but desirable. And respect was always due to existing institutions. Conservatism had many different faces. In England, with which the professed modern conservatives typically associated, it surely stood for a defense of the common law and parliament, the established church, and not in the least the gentry. The conservatives there were, in defending parliamentary rule, surely democratic. In Germany in the early 19th century, on the other hand, it stood for the restoration of absolute monarchy, of censorship, of petty tyranny, of military officials, or for a political police. that tried to snuff out radicals, though with very little success. While in Russia, it occurred in the form of a debate between liberal westernizers and conservative Slavophiles, who wanted, as I mentioned in an earlier lecture, to return to the sacred unity of Holy Russia, that was epitomized by ancient Muscovy, and they bewailed the westernizing impact of Peter the Great. Finally, as this is an aspect of Western political thought and action in the 19th century that is barely mentioned, let alone addressed, in standard histories of political ideas, Western political thought by 1800 now directly involved the lives of 130 million people on the Indian subcontinent as well. Not in some fake sense of borrowing ideas any longer, but rather in direct policy making. In the early 19th century, colonial officials in India were namely involved in a long debate between what I would broadly call a conservative school that argued that taxes on land in India should be assessed on the basis of tax systems that had existed on the moment of the British takeover, and to argue too the British should work on the basis of pre-existing institutions that should be strengthened on the British rule on the one hand, and the liberal or utilitarian school on the other, which argued that taxes should be based on the estimated productivity of the land, and that barbaric Indian institutions should be brushed aside to give way to British security of property and the rule of law. All this was a life and death matter for Indian peasants, as a little more tax could push them from poverty into starvation. Not only was India by 1800 a laboratory for British political ideas, but as Parliament assumed sovereignty over India, the lives of millions of Indians came to depend on party politics in England, without them, of course, having any say in it. Whence it may safely be said, too, that the East India Company was, ironically, a bulwark of liberalism, pleading for the kind of representative government which surely did not exist in India, and of political economy that pleaded for low taxes, while in India the claims of such economists always ensued in higher taxes. So, in the first half of the 19th century, politics in Europe, and by extension in its colonies, came to revolve around the struggle between a conservative right, who in internal English politics, for example, opposed any extension of the suffrage, or Catholic emancipation, or repeal of the Corn Laws that favored the landed gentry, on the one hand, and the liberal left who wanted reform of the suffrage, no more discrimination of Catholics, free trade, and repeal of the Corn Laws. And in India, the liberals favored an interventionist policy to abolish abuses like widow burning ceremonies or killing of babies. And they wanted to introduce a comprehensive system of English law, rather than the somewhat modified Islamic and Hindu law that had been used so far. And the conservative pleaded for abstaining from interference in Indian society as much as possible. On the European continent, this struggle between left and right revolved around the attempts, after the final defeat of the French Revolution in 1815, to reverse its results and to quietly return to the world as had existed before the revolution. Whether that be in the form of some revitalized kind of absolutism, or abolishing parliaments and diets, or reintroduce legal privileges for the aristocracy. Though admittedly, no government in Europe tried to introduce serfdom again, nor did any government in Europe dare to touch the redivision of land that had been achieved by the revolution, so that tenant farmers who had obtained their land during the revolution were generally not expropriated. Whence in France, in northern Spain, in northern Portugal, and parts of Germany, the peasants tended to be a very conservative, if not altogether a reactionary group, as they feared liberal governments might, if not expropriate them, then at least be supportive of those banks to which they were often heavily in debt, as we observed in Sicily already. Conservatism, in short, was the party of the nobility, the church, the estate owners of rich peasants and part of the army, against which was broadly arranged the liberal bourgeoisie, in a kind of shifting alliance with the working classes. Basically, the revolutions of 1848 were revolutions of artisans in the cities who were led by liberal lawyers, small factory owners. This conservative class articulation, as the Marxists call it, simply did not exist in the USA. There was neither a nobility there, nor a state church, nor much of an army, nor a separate class of latifundistas, great estate owners, nor in fact was there a class of poor, and in the Americas that meant Indian peasants, so that European conservatism did not resound in the USA at all, and American historians tend typically to underrate the strength of this conservative coalition. The 19th century was in Belgium, in France, in Scandinavia, or in England, surely the bourgeois age. Elsewhere, even in Ireland, it likely was not. In South America, it was rather the age of the great latifundistas and authoritarian caudillo. For this coalition did exist in Latin America, and conservatism widely resounded there, as in the writings of Lucas Alamán in Mexico, who, very similarly, as any European conservative might, argued that effective policy should not proceed from speculative legislators who pretend to subject the human race to imaginary principles that they want to pass as oracles of eternal truth. Though the various conservative and authoritarian caudillo regimes that emerged in Latin America in the 1830s, such as that Juan Manuel Rosas in Argentina, were generally blissfully ignorant of any such theorizing, and they mainly acted to defend their own fortunes and those of their own class, the rich estate owner. Now, in dealing with classical liberalism, I first need to clarify a very common mistake. In the USA nowadays, what is called liberal stands for what in Europe would be called social democracy. That is a redistribution of wealth by distributive programs, and still a very sensitive issue in the USA, a policy of positive discrimination, that is allowing jobs to minorities, but read African Americans, by reserving jobs for them. The one central doctrine of the English and American variety of classic liberalism was liberty, and that was defined by the classic liberal thinker John Stuart Mill as follows. And this is Victorian writing, so I'll excuse for the very long sentences. Liberty was a sphere of action in which society, as distinguished from the individual, has only an indirect interest. It comprehends all that portion of a person's life and conduct that only affects himself, or, if it affects others, only affects them with their free, voluntary, and undeceived consent and participation. Liberty comprises first the inward domain of consciousness. It demands liberty of conscience in the most comprehensive sense. It demands liberty of thought and feeling, absolute freedom of opinion and sentiments on all subjects, practical or speculative, scientific, moral, or theological. Second, the principle requires liberty of tastes and pursuits, of framing the plan of our life to suit our own character, doing as we like, subject to such consequences as may follow, without impediment from our fellow creatures, so long as what we do does not harm them, even though they should think our conduct foolish, perverse, or wrong. Thirdly, from the liberty of each individual follows the liberty, within the same limits, of combination amongst individuals. Freedom to unite for any purpose not involving harm to others, the persons combining being supposed to be of full age and not forced or deceived. Typical for the US and British liberalism by the 1860s was thus a policy of minimal state interference in society that became known as the orthodoxy of the night watchman state, in which the state was merely to maintain law and order, defend the borders against foreign enemies, or in the USA, defend the settlers against the Indians, and perhaps carry out a few services that serve the community as a whole, such as the post office or providing clean water, but in which it was not to interfere in the free market or in the press or in the curriculum taught by schools or universities. Ideas that were not only realized in the USA and in Britain, but in India as well, where the guiding principle of government became by 1870 for the colonial government to have a hands-off attitude towards Indian society. It did not intervene in matters of religion, nor, unless publications were deemed very seditious, in the press or in the free market. Yet all this was only partly applicable to the European continent, to Latin America, or to Russia. There, the liberal bourgeoisie might feel the doctrine of free trade and non-interference in the market the English were preaching, indeed all such principles at large, only served the interest of the Manchester industrialists and of the British Empire. So that in Germany, in a way, to follow historians Robin Blackburn and Geoffrey Ely, the liberal bourgeoisie was willing to come to an arrangement in which the Prussian state was to heavily protect industry, subsidize trade against British competition, and was allotted a minimal say over the state by means of an elected parliament. All this in return for the bourgeoisie leaving the apparatus of state and the army entirely in control of the Junkers. Again, such non-interference of the state in society as the British pleaded for would merely perpetuate the semi-servile status of Indian laborers on the Latin American estates or that of the Russian mujiks. In Latin America, the liberal watchword, rather than liberty, became positivism or cientismo. In Latin American liberalism, a strong and, if necessary, authoritarian state that was to guard the nation against the excesses and anarchy of the masses, read the Indian or black slave masses, was to implement a scientific reform of society. That thorough reform was to be led by a neutral vanguard of social scientists. They were going to pull the peasant masses out of their state of backwardness and achieve national order and progress, as the motto of the Brazilian flag reads. Those ideas, often tallied with further results of the then social sciences, that the masses, and that meant the Indian masses, were not backward as a result of economic forces, but rather because they simply had smaller brains, or by their general rural stupor. For the officials in Latin America in the 19th century had generally as low a regard for the campesinos as the French one I reviewed in an earlier lecture, so that they had to think for those naturally backward and disadvantaged masses. Yet the problem for the cientificos was, that the elites were not willing to pay to uplift the masses, and all their ideas thus ran into a brick wall of deficient funds to realize their magnificent program. And in Russia, the watchword of liberalism became modernization. The state was to pull the Russian peasants out of the backwardness, and it was broadly to copy such Western institutions as parliament and free press. Yet there were few signs Tsarist autocracy was willing to concede to any of such demands. Although, admittedly, Tsar Alexander II in the 70s made some cautious moves towards reforming the judiciary and was considering establishing a parliament just before he was murdered in 1881. The liberal intellectuals that had absconded Moscow and Petersburg University, as well as new provincial ones as that of Kazan, in ever-increasing numbers, grew thus increasingly alienated with and despondent of their seemingly perpetually backward country and with their seemingly equally stupid Tsarist autocracy as well. A regime in which even the slightest inkling of any independent thought led straight to Siberian exile, or for that matter, to Italian exile. Mind you, to Russians, the latter was the worse verdict. As for example, Russia's greatest liberal thinker, Alexander Herzen, who spent most of his life as a political exile in London, just like Marx or Bakunin, and who spoke of Russia as that, quote, monster, which needs so many victims and permits its children only the sad alternative of losing themselves morally in a setting that is hostile to all human, or dying at the dawning of their lives. Russia is an abyss, where the greatest talents will be swallowed before ever having achieved anything. For that group of alienated intellectuals, who were unlike the ones of the Enlightenment, preaching to a virtually deaf parish, the Russian writers began to use a new word that they developed in the 1840s, namely the intelligentsia, a separate group, a kind of sect, tied neither to class nor to state. The intelligentsia had its own venerated heroes, whom had to have a history of brushes with the state authority, whose officials were seen as capricious, inefficient, bureaucratic, and uncultured. So that the intelligentsia defined itself both opposition to the state and in opposition to the people, whom the intelligentsia had to pull out of the darkness in which they lingered. Yet, in reality, they were gradually giving up on the masses as on the state, as indeed on their country, so that even the modest liberal intelligentsia came increasingly to argue with Shigalov in Dostoevsky's novel The Demons from 1863. Quote, to cut the matter short, for we can't go on talking for another 30 years as people have done for the last 30. I ask you, what do you prefer? The slow way, which consists in the composition of socialist romance and the academic ordering of the destinies of humanity in 1,000 years' time, while despotism will swallow the savory morsels which would almost fly into your mouth of themselves if you take a little trouble? Or do you, whatever it may imply, prefer a quicker way, which will at least untie your hands and will let humanity make its own social organization in freedom and in action and not in paper? They shout, this will cost 100 million heads. That may be only a metaphor. But why be afraid of it? If, with the slow daydreams on paper, despotism, in the course of some 100 years, will devour not 100, but 500 million heads. Take note, too, that an incurable invalid will not be cured, whatever prescriptions are written for him on paper. On the contrary, if there is delay, he will grow so corrupt that he will infect us too, and contaminate all the fresh forces which one might still reckon upon now, so that we shall at last come to grief altogether. This passage was a pretty accurate prediction of what was going to happen in Russia eventually, whence it's worth a long quote. And whence too, the demons were, if too much of a classic to be prohibited, stamped a work of petty bourgeois obscurantism during the Stalinist period, only to be read under expert guidance. The other central tenet of classical liberalism was representative government, defined by Mill as that form of government in which the sovereignty, or supreme controlling power in the last resort, is vested in the entire aggregate of the community. Every citizen, not only having a voice in the exercise of that ultimate sovereignty, but being, at least occasionally, called on to take an actual part in the government by the personal discharge of some public function, local or general. But since all cannot, in a community exceeding a small town, participate personally in any but some very minor portions of the public business, it follows that the ideal form of a perfect government must be representative. Before we turn to the underside of 19th century liberalism, that will lead us on to social democracy, let me first emphasize that if the bourgeoisie then congratulated itself at having attained not merely the greatest material progress, but also the greatest moral perfection in all of history, it was in many respects not wrong. And the future was going to be even brighter. Yet, predicted historian Thomas Babington Macaulay in 1866, quote, "We too shall, in our turn, be outstripped. And we too shall in our turn be envied." It may well be, in the 20th century, that laboring men may be as little used to dine without meat as they are now little used to eating rye bread. That sanitary police and medical discoveries may have added several more years to the average length of human life. That numerous comforts and luxuries, which are now unknown or confined to but a few, may be within the reach of every working man. And yet it may then be the mode to assert that the increase of wealth and progress of science have benefited the few at the expense of the many, and to talk of the reign of Queen Victoria as that time when England was truly Merry England, when all classes were bound together by brotherly sympathy, and when the rich did not grind the faces of the poor, and the poor did not envy the splendor of the rich. End quote. And there was particular progress in several causes the Enlightenment had already rallied against, but had not been able to achieve. Thus, for instance, the European states in the middle of the 19th century, everywhere, and for that matter the British in India as well, gradually made an end to those public executions that had featured as a prominent feature of the cityscape and as most popular form of entertainment for 1,000 years. Executions were henceforth to be done by rapid hanging in the privacy of a prison, with preferably merely the executioner, perhaps a priest, present. Moreover, there was also an increasingly vocal campaign to abolish the death penalty altogether. And though governments still pleaded they needed capital punishment, it was now only used as penalty for murder rather than for mere petty theft or debts, as was still common in the 18th. Then again, all European governments in the 19th century abolished and prohibited the application of torture during police investigations, though admittedly, torture was still common in the colonies. Again, there was also increasing concern with cruelty against animals. In England, the first animal protection societies were founded in the 1820s. They rallied against such things as cockfighting, the most popular spectator sport in 18th century England, and the equally popular bull baiting, in which a bull was set upon by dogs specially trained for the purpose. They were all abolished in the 1840s, so that the Victorians could, with characteristic snobbishness, congratulate themselves on how they had finally ended a sport that was more degrading to those who watch it than to those who perform it. Unlike those barbaric Spanish, who carried on with their own variety of the bullfight. Yet the animal protection societies also already protested against the vivisection of dogs by what the activist for animal rights called philosophical butchers, of which the only long-term result was that dogs were later on replaced by mice. Again, the 19th century was, as the French social historian Philippe Ariès argued in a classic study, the century of childhood, in which the child was not only to be protected against cruelty, so that many states in Europe began to employ social workers who could put children in a state orphanage if their parents showed irresponsible parenthood, such as neglecting the children or beating them, but in which the child was also increasingly sheltered from the adult world to inhabit henceforth his or her own separate children's land, a sheltered heaven of love and affection in a hostile world. This children land was obviously very much a middle class and bourgeois idea. Workers had simply insufficient space to seclude children from such adult affairs as sex. It is, after all, very difficult to have a separate children's world if you have as a couple to share one very tiny room with your children. And that was more or less the norm for people from the working classes in the city. Ariès' notion of a revolution in attitudes towards children is contestable too. Yet he is surely not entirely wrong. One of the most striking differences between Europe and Africa, that had not witnessed such a creation of a children's land, is in my view that spaces such as bars, which are in Europe completely off-limits to children, are full of them. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, with the major exception of Imperial Russia, all European states by the 1840s had abolished the discrimination of religious minorities in general, and of the Jews very much in particular. Having mentioned all these great advances in civilization, as they said in the 19th century, with some reason, there were still two skeletons in the cupboard of 19th century liberalism, colonialism and inequality. As to the first, what was colonial rule to be for? Was it to benefit all classes of the colonized population and to train them politically, so that in due course they might all benefit from the blessings of representative government and liberal freedom, so that the English could then retreat from India, a day that shall be the proudest day in the history of the English race, as such liberals as Macaulay claimed or imagined? Or did colonialism really serve only a small group of Europeans? Most liberals, such as Indian Viceroy Lord Ripon, argued it was to be in the interest of the Indians, by introducing enlightened institutions such as English education, good governance and rule of law, or such material improvements as railroads or uniform postage. Yet Judge Fitzjames Stephens, perhaps judged the entire liberal case best when he wrote on Ripon's rhapsodizing on all those blessings of British rule, quote, "If the government of India has decided to remove all anomalies from India, they ought first to remove themselves and their countrymen. The government of India is an absolute government, founded not on consent but on conquest, and no anomaly can be as striking as those who at the head of that government found on conquest shrink from the straightforward acknowledgement of it and seek to apologize their own position." So that all that liberalism in the colonies was, as Stevens recognized, essentially a scam, with the very major exception of the settlement colonies. And the second skeleton in the liberal cupboard was well recognized by Mill himself, when he described his intellectual development from 1820 to 1860 as follows, quote, "In my early days, I had seen little further than the old school of political economists into the possibilities of fundamental improvement in social arrangements. Private property and inheritance appear to me, as to them, the dernier mot, the last word, of legislation, and I looked no further than to mitigating the inequalities consequent on these institutions. The notion that it was possible to go further than that in removing the injustice, for injustice it is, whether admitting of a complete remedy or not, involved in the fact that some are born to riches and the vast majority to poverty, I then reckoned chimerical, and I only hoped that by universal education the portion of the poor might be made more tolerable. In short, I was a democrat, but no socialist. But our ideal of ultimate improvement, ultimately, in 1860, went far beyond democracy, and it would class us, Mill and his wife Harriet Fraser, decidedly under the general designation of socialists. While we repudiated with the greatest energy that tyranny of society over the individual which most socialist systems are supposed to involve, we yet looked forward to a time when society will no longer be divided into the idle and the industrious, when the rule that they who do not work shall not eat will not be applied to paupers only, but impartially to all, when the division of the produce of labor, instead of depending, as in so great a degree it now does, on the accident of birth, will be made by concert on an acknowledged principle of justice, and when it will no longer either be or thought to be impossible for human beings to exert themselves strenuously in procuring benefits that are not exclusively their own, but are to be shared with the society they all belong to." When Mill, whom incidentally Marx singled out as the bourgeois economist par excellence, actually made the best case pro and con of socialism. On the one hand, socialism surely implied tyranny of society over the individual. Yet can any society in which the division of the produce of labor entirely depends on the accident of birth truly call itself democratic? As the founder of the Labour Party, John Hyndman, described it, periods of flesh prosperity, speedily followed by depressions, which pinch and starve even the best artisan glass, education progressing so slowly that still another generation will be suffered to grow up instructed enough only to be ignorant, overcrowded insanitary dwellings, permitted to continue and paid for at an exorbitant price, because that is to the benefit of the classes who trade upon the necessity of their fellows, fast monopolies encouraged by the state. Here we have the boasted freedom of the latter half of the 19th century. Our civilization is in many respects but an organized hypocrisy, filming over as ultrous places below as ever disgraced the worst period of past history. Moreover, the common connection between free market capitalism and democracy, where it is now generally argued the one necessarily comes with the other, since supposedly markets can only thrive in a free society, is a 20th century concoction. In the real 19th century, the capitalist rich, when they had attained to vote for themselves by the 1840s in France, Britain, Belgium, or the Netherlands, were not at all willing to then grant that vote to the working classes. Instead, they insisted on tying the vote to tax or property qualifications, while obviously denying it to women altogether, so that the working class, as much as the suffragettes in all these countries, had to struggle another 40 years for skilled workers, and commonly another 70 years for unskilled workers and women to attain the vote. General suffrage, that is, real democracy, was in Europe only attained after World War I, with one sole exception, Switzerland, that instituted general male suffrage in 1848, and then ironically withheld the vote to women until 1972, the penultimate country in the world to do so. So, as the working classes were not represented at all in 19th century parliaments, these were really all debating societies for the propertied classes, so that the social democratic parties fundamentally formed round the issue of one man, one vote, rather than that, as was common in the 19th century electoral systems, rich persons with several houses had several votes. Furthermore, the liberty of assembly the liberal bourgeoisie claimed for itself, for decades, until the end of the 19th century, did decidedly not include any right of workers to either organize themselves in unions or to strike, both of which in most European countries remained prohibited for decades after the introduction of parliamentary rule in the 1860s, and in the colonies mostly only until the 1950s. Basic democratic liberties, in other words, were not somehow gladly granted by the capitalists, as is now the common view. Rather, it took decades of struggle for the working classes to attain those liberties. Yet there is one critical exception to all that. General male, that is white and excluding Native Americans, homologated foreigners, suffrage in the United States was introduced, though some states managed to delay it for 30 years, during the presidency of Andrew Jackson from 1829 to 1837. Andrew Jackson is the founder of the modern Democratic Party, that basically represented a coalition between the farmers and parts of the working classes in the city. That Jacksonian Democratic Party represented a wide range of views, yet it shared a commitment to the concept of an agrarian society, and they viewed central government as the enemy of individual liberty, and believed that government intervention in the economy benefited special interest groups and created corporate monopolies that favored the rich. That is a stance that is still common enough in the USA, from the Tea Party movement to the Libertarians, but it was really only possible in an agrarian society, such as the USA was under Jackson, with lots of surplus land, so that the produce of the land could not be monopolized by a tiny group of landlords, though it is arguable that Jacksonian democracy may have prevented the kind of land grabbing by landlords as occurred during the Rosas dictatorship in Argentina in the same period. Now, as social democratic movements in Europe generally formed around demands for general suffrage, this is one reason why in the USA they were very slow to emerge and then always remained somewhat marginal. The only candidate of a social democratic party to run for presidential office in the USA in the first decade of the 20th century, Eugene Debs, never attained more than 2.8% of the vote. Or why there was no socialism, or more precisely, why there were no social democratic parties in the USA, for which the great economic historian Bernd Sombart, in a classic book from 1900, gave three further reasons. It all remained perfectly valid, except the last one, until the present day. First, that American politics could always play both the race and foreign immigrants card to redirect possible hostility from capitalists towards African Americans or filthy Latin immigrants. Second, that unlike European political parties that generally represent clear-cut socio-economic or religious interests, both the Republican and Democratic Party represented and represent a broad array of groups and interests. Those two parties had virtually monopolized American politics, so that even radical demands had to be accommodated within one of those two parties, such as was the case with the short-lived People's Party in the 1890s that was more or less absorbed in the Democratic Party, and that mainly ran on the issue of the nationalization of banks. For the activist argued, rather than that of the people, say's government was now one of Wall Street, by Wall Street, and for Wall Street. Some slogans never change. And finally and critically, wages in the USA were not only 4 times higher than in Germany, but had been rising throughout the 19th century. Inequalities in the USA during the Gilded Age, as the late 19th century is known there, were as stark, likely starker, than in Europe. Yet the conditions of the laborers in the USA had demonstrably been improving over the course of the last 100 years. Unlike in Europe, as Hyndman underlined. Yet if social democratic parties did not thrive in the USA, this does not mean that socialism is somehow un-American, something for exotic Germans and Russians with beards. The single greatest bestseller, after Uncle Tom's Cabin, in 19th century America, was Edward Bellamy's Looking Backwards from 2000 to 1887, in which the hero falls asleep in a year in which small companies are increasingly being swallowed by big trusts, until there is merely one company left in 1900. And then, to quote Bellamy, the following occurred. The industry and commerce of the country, ceasing to be conducted by a set of irresponsible corporations and syndicates of private persons at their caprice and for their profit, were entrusted to a single syndicate, a syndicate that represented the people, to be conducted in the common interest of the common profit. At last, strangely late in world's history, the obvious fact was perceived that no business is so essentially the public business as the industry and commerce on which the people's livelihood depends, and that to entrust it to private persons to be managed for private property is a folly similar in kind, though vastly greater in magnitude, to that of surrendering the functions of political government to kings and nobles, to be conducted for their personal glorification. Such phrases would probably nowadays class the author as belonging to the lunatic leftist fringe. Yet in 1887, this was given the massive sales of Bellamy's book, apparently the view of large parts, if not the majority, of America's population. Now, in approaching social democratic movements, or broadly working class movements, for despite of attempts of some historians to prove the opposite, the following of social democratic movements was overwhelmingly derived from the laboring classes, artisans, engineers, industrial workers as blue-collar workers, and clerks and so on as white-collar workers in the cities, we encounter as exuberant a forest of views as is the case with liberalism. There was not one liberalism, there were dozens. And there were even more kinds of socialism. Not only as the various left-wing movements of the 19th century had a tradition of incessant disagreements and quarrels over to outsiders often rather obscure doctrinal issues, but also as the various working classes they represented were very different. Thus, for example, the Dutch social democratic movement was a movement on the one hand representing the working classes of Amsterdam, and it was particularly strong amongst the Jewish diamond workers. Indeed, in Amsterdam, being a Jew meant being an atheist social democrat. And on the other hand, the movement represented poor rural laborers and laborers in cardboard factories in the north of the country, Groningen, Friesland. And it was particularly strong amongst rural laborers in the eastern part of Groningen, which featured a particularly sharp cleft between disenfranchised poor laborers and rich farmers. Incidentally, all eastern Groningen is the only region of the Netherlands where the Dutch Communist Party still runs in local elections. In contrast, the Social Democrat Party had few followers in the south of the country, or indeed in the main port of Rotterdam, where working class movements were dominated by the Catholic and Protestant social movements. Thus too, the French working class movement was very much an artisan movement. Artisans who worked, as in the 18th century, in small ateliers, with perhaps a dozen employees, and to produce things like furniture or fashion. There were, to be sure, in France, rapidly growing factory towns, such as Saint-Étienne, Metz, or Roubaix, places that, with good reasons, are still habitually skipped in any touristic itinerary of France. But the French labor movement was primarily concentrated in Lyon, in Marseille, and above all in Paris. And Paris was the world capital of fashion, of art, and of revolution in the 19th century, as the Paris working class proudly looked back on the glory days of the sans-culottes, and then later on on the Paris Commune of 1871, which was in some ways a replay of the Commune during the heyday of the revolution under the Jacobins. Except that the Paris Commune of 1871 was an exclusively working class movement. It was smothered by the French government, with silent German aid, who were as afraid of revolution as the French government was, in a truly barbaric way. At least 17,000 people were killed, and 45,000 more exiled to places like Guyana, of French Caledonia, off the coast of New Guinea, or to Algeria. Algeria became in the 19th century a kind of dump for subversive elements of the government of Spain, participant in the Carlist Wars, Italian Carbonari, or the Communard of 1871 from France. And it is indeed a sad irony that all these revolutionaries, grandchildren, as privileged pieds noirs colonists in Algeria, to defend their privileges, then began to turn to the right and to the extreme right in the 20th century. Now, the most basic split, or as you like it, the schism, within the working class movement, that has really not been healed until the present, was that between the socialists, led by Karl Marx, and the anarchists, led by Mikhail Bakunin, when the anarchists were expelled in 1872 from Marx's First Workerman International. The socialists argued that the movement was to take over the state in the interest of the working classes, followed by a first phase of socialism and then a second stage of communism, in which, as classes were now completely abolished, a state that served to maintain the class system would gradually wither away. The anarchists, however, wanted to abolish the state now and here, rather than waiting for communism first. And they opposed the kind of rigid party organization Marx and his followers pleaded for, too. For, according to Bakunin, Marx's program is a complete fabric of political and economic institutions, strongly centralized and very authoritarian, sanctioned, no doubt, like all despotic institutions in modern society, by universal suffrage, but subordinate, nevertheless, to a very strong government. So that Marx wanted for Bakunin a universal state, a government, a dictatorship. The dream of Pope Gregory VII, of Charles V and Napoleon, that only reproduces itself under a new form, but always with the same pretensions in the camp of socialist democracy. I leave it to the listeners whether or not that was an accurate prediction of the shape and direction Marx's revolution was eventually to take. Yet the anarchists, according to Bakunin, think that the necessary revolutionary policy of the proletariat must have for its immediate and only object the destruction of the state. We do not understand that anyone could speak of international solidarity when they want to keep the state, for the state by its very nature is a rupture of this solidarity, and consequently it is a permanent cause of war. Neither do we understand how anybody could speak of the freedom of the proletariat or the deliverance of the masses in the state and by the state. State means domination, and all domination presupposes the subjection of the masses and consequently their exploitation to the profit of some minority or other, including the party leadership of that supposed socialist state too. So the anarchist believed that a small revolutionary vanguard, no more than a few thousand persons, should set an example to the masses, an example that would cause them to spontaneously rise up against their capitalist oppressors. That was to be done by what the anarchist called the propaganda of the deed. It eventually turned into a terrorist campaign, including assassinations, bomb attacks, or bank robberies. A campaign that at the end of the 19th century caused the death of dozens of dignitaries, including King Umberto of Italy and President McKinley of the USA. That anarchist campaign was, in short, the first international terrorist campaign. The word terrorist itself dates back to the terreur of the French Revolution, but that was really what would now be designated state terrorism. But as an ism, terrorism derives from the first international conference to combat terrorism that was held at Lausanne in 1898 on the urgings of the Austro-Hungarian government in the aftermath of the murder of Sisi. Though, unlike most modern terrorists, But like their closest modern kin, the German Bader-Meinhof group in the 70s, who similarly believed that murdering dignitaries would be the signal to a general uprising of the masses, the anarchists did not target random passers-by as rather key figures of state or economy. All this obviously caused an enormous amount of panic within the police forces, and even more within the ruling classes. And it did much to cement the image of the anarchist that has remained till today. The crazed fanatic with a revolver or bomb hidden under his trench coat, however noble his ideas might be. Yet the anarchists' numbers remain minuscule. The police estimated there were perhaps 1,000 anarchists in France in 1900, a few hundred in Switzerland, Russia and Belgium, 4,000 in the USA, perhaps 8,000 in Italy and a few hundred in India. The one critical exception was Spain, and Catalonia in particular, where the anarchists successfully managed to take over the labor unions in the beginning of the 20th century, so that only in Spain, and hardly by coincidence, in what was really the overseas extension of the Spanish laboring class, the one in Buenos Aires, anarchism succeeded in gathering a mass following. But beyond Spain, the anarchists were utterly eclipsed by the strictly organized and regimented Social Democratic Workers' Parties, united in the Second Working Men International, established in 1882. That Socialist International represented by 1900 a group of mass political parties in France, Belgium, Italy, the Netherlands, Sweden, Austria and above all in Germany, where the almighty Socialistische Partei Deutschlands, which had 2% of the vote in 1870, had attained 35% of the vote in 1912, and it would surely command the majority in the Reichstag in the next elections in 1916, it was then generally believed, and socialism could then be established in Germany. That mighty Socialistische Partei Deutschlands also very much dominated the Workers' International, so that its proceedings were held in German. And the socialists could by 1900 not only feel that the Second International would soon rule the world, but that the vanguard of the transition of the masses towards socialism would be the world's most advanced capitalist economy, just as Marx had predicted, namely Germany. All this in contrast to backward Russia, the Social Democratic Party of which of course was prohibited and persecuted by the Okhrana, consisted of a somewhat comical bunch of refugees, who were mostly occupied quarreling amongst each other. Its majority faction, the Bolsheviks, had less than 8,000 members in 1905, 13,000 in 1906 and 46,000 in 1907, and its minority faction, the Mensheviks, had even less members. So that if there was to be a revolution at all, and some German social democrats doubted by 1900 whether that still would be necessary, given the good results of the SPD at the polls, so that socialism might well be introduced by parliamentary majority, it would surely be in Germany. Whence the SPD, as the direct inheritor of Marx, to more or less reserve the right to itself to pontificate on what line other parties were to follow, and, for that matter, to decide on what the correct interpretation of Marx was to be. An interpretation it called dialectical materialism. As well as to defend Marx against all those non-Marxists, whom, as the guardian of Marx's legacy in the party, Karl Kautsky quipped, would very much like to make people believe that Marx considered those who shared his point of view as idiots, utterly incapable of thinking for themselves, or that the Marxists are incapable of understanding Marx, and that the non-Marxists are therefore called upon to defend Marx's theory from the fanaticism of the Marxists. That is indeed arguably still fairly typical for what Marx commonly taught in the academic world. Yet if Marx was no doubt a towering figure in that emerging international socialist movement, there were many different and distinct traditions flowing into the social democratic movement as well. And there were many social democratic traditions that were completely distinct from the German one. And in particular, there was a separate British tradition of socialism that went back to the Chartist movement of the early 19th century. So that the British working class movement not only predated social democracies on the European continent, but owed little or nothing to Marx's view. In the land where he lived, Marx was during his lifetime completely unknown. Thus, in its most radical shape, the independent labor movement, that was by and large based on the unions and that attempted to influence the trade unions to back a working class party. The socialism practiced by the Independent Labour Party, historian David Howell writes about it, was ideal for achieving that end, because, quote, lacking as it did any real theoretical basis, it could accommodate practically anything a trade unionist was likely to demand. Fervent and emotional, the socialism of the Independent Labour Party could accommodate, with only a little strain, temperance reform, Scottish nationalism, Methodism, Marxism, Fabian gradualism, and even a variety of conservatism. Although that mixture was a curious one, it did have the one overwhelming virtue of excluding nobody on dogmatic grounds. And then there was its moderate wing, the gradualist Fabian socialists, who saw the achievement of socialism as a process of gradual social reconstruction rather than as proceeding from a revolution in that odd French continental way, and as the Marxists would have it. Fabianism was in a way the realization of John Stuart's Mill's ideals rather than of Karl Marx, so that the British Fabian socialist, to quote its most prominent spokesman, George Bernard Shaw, know that it was only through the slow and gradual turning of the popular mind to new principles that social reorganization bit by bit comes. All students of society who are abreast of their own time realize that important organic change can only be democratic and thus acceptable to a majority of the people and prepared for in the minds of all. Organic change can only be gradual, causing no dislocation, however rapid may be the rate of progress. It should not be regarded as immoral by the mass of the people, and thus not demoralizing to them, and in this country at any rate, it should be constitutional and peaceful. A position, in brief, that the SPD, which officially still clung to the vision of the proletariat toppling the bourgeoisie in a violent revolution, would have branded revisionist. But that was almost from the outset of the entire party the position of the British Labour Party. It was a position, too, that the labour movement in a way exported both to the British colonies, such as to India, where British labour activists from the 1880s onward tried to establish unions and, if possible, pull the yet rudimentary Indian national movement towards a labour position and to the Commonwealth. And very much in particular, they did so to Australia. Cultural historian Louis Hartz argued that European settler societies are fragments of European societies that reflect the dominant culture as the settlers left the motherland. Thus, according to Hartz, the USA is a Puritan fragment stemmed by the early rise of British Parliament. But Australia is rather a radical proletarian and collectivist fragment. It reflects the values of the British working class in the 19th century, and it was charged by all the turmoil of the age of the Industrial Revolution. Now, of course, this is too general a view to be completely acceptable or applicable. Yet it is arguable that Australian society was indeed from the outset stemmed by a rough sense of working class egalitarianism, an egalitarianism that resented aristocratic, or for that matter, bourgeois privileges, so that attempts in the 1840s to establish an Australian nobility stranded on general local ridicule, and in which the employers were always to allow the employees a fair and equitable wage, a fair wage for a fair day's work, as the slogan of labour. And Australia, too, was to be a socialism of equal opportunities for all, though not of equal wealth for all. Thus, the reformist message of the Fabians and the Independent Labour Party fell on a particularly fertile ground down under, as did above all Bellamy, who is the founding father of the Australian labour movement, whereas it had little to do with Marx, whom nobody knew down under. Nor was Australia present in the Workers' International. Labour publications were not only avidly read in Australia, but the first Australian unions, established in the 80s, were practically cardboard copies of British unions. And by 1900, Australia already boasted an exceptionally heavily unionized working class. In the 1920s, some 45% of all workers in Australia carried a union card, as against less than 9% in the USA and 32% in England. During the depression of the 90s of the 19th century, there were in Australia major strikes of shearers and dock workers that, though they were broken by employers and the state governments, led to the rise of the Australian Labour Party that already came to power in Queensland in 1899. By 1914, Labour ruled all Australian states, and in 1910, Australia formed the first Labour government in the world, with half the votes and 42 seats. A Labour government that established a comprehensive system of social security, whereas then the USA can be perceived as the shining realization of the liberal principles of the 19th century. In a way, Australia was turning into the shining realization of the gradualist socialism of the Fabian stamp. Now, Oscar Wilde cheered all these new socialist ideas and socialist principles in 1891, for he argued, under socialism there will be no people living in fetid dens and fetid rags, bringing up unhealthy, hunger-pinched children in the midst of impossible and absolutely repulsive surroundings. Each member of society will share under socialism in the general prosperity and happiness of the society. And socialism, communism, or whatever you choose to call it, by converting private property into public wealth, and substituting cooperation for competition, will restore society to its proper condition of a thoroughly healthy organism and ensure material well-being for each member of the community. Socialism will, in fact, give life its proper basis and its proper environment. Yet for the full development of life to its highest mode of perfection, something more is needed. What is needed is individualism. If socialism is authoritarian, if it is a government armed with economic power, as it is now with political power, if, in a word, it is an industrial tyranny, then the last state of man will be worse than the first. For while under the present system a very large number of people can lead lives of a certain amount of freedom of expression and happiness, under such an industrial barrack system, or a system of economic tyranny, nobody will be able to have any freedom at all. It is to be regretted that a portion of our community should practically be in slavery, but to propose to solve the problem by enslaving the whole community is childish. Now, this is arguably a problem with socialism that is still not solved. Yet, pursued Wilde, any scheme to reconcile socialism or communism with individual freedom is, quote, quite impractical and goes against human nature. This is perfectly true. It is impractical and it goes against human nature. And that is why it is worth carrying out. For what is a practical scheme? A practical scheme is either a scheme that is already in existence or a scheme that could be carried out under existing conditions. But it is exactly the existing conditions that one objects to. And any scheme that could accept these conditions is wrong and foolish. The conditions will be done away with, and human nature will change. The only thing that one really knows about human nature is that it changes. Change is the one quality we can predicate of it. The systems that fail are those that rely on the permanency of human nature and not on its growth and development.